Without cover songs, the world wouldn't have many well-loved classics from Aretha Franklin, Whitney Houston, Johnny Cash, or even the Beatles. Music journalist Ray Padgett founded the blog Cover Me in 2007 to tell the stories behind cover songs and has grown it into the largest blog devoted to the subject on the web with 80,000 individual readers a month. In Padgett's new book, Cover Me, he tells the story of the cover song from Elvis's Hound Dog and the Beatles' Twist and Shout to Johnny Cash's Hurt and Adele's Make You Feel My Love. The book is published by Sterling, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Ray Padgett to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let us begin with a baseline for the purposes of this book, for the purposes of your list of the greatest cover songs of all time. What definition did you decide on of what makes a cover song?
So the definition I landed on was essentially a song that has been previously written, recorded, and released. So it's not only a song that you yourself didn't write, though that's certainly part of it, but it also has to be a song that you're learning from another recording, not just a song that, you know, a professional songwriter wrote for you.
And it didn't have to be a hit, right? It didn't have to be a hit its first time around.
No, not at all. About half the songs in the book were hits the first time around, and about half are songs that no one would know otherwise, like, you know, Killing Me Softly.
I heard he sang a good song. I heard he had a style. And so I came to see him to listen for a while. And there he was, this young boy, a stranger to my eyes.
Both Roberta Flack and the Fugees had hits with it. Neither of them was the original. The original was a singer-songwriter named Lori Lieberman.
I felt all flushed with fever, embarrassed by the crowd. I felt he found my letters and read each one out loud. I prayed that he would finish, but he just kept right on.
And it was super obscure. No one would know that song except for the covers.
I want to get into several of the songs that you write about in the book, but how did you land on these particular songs? Were these songs that came to you quite easily, or is it through the research that you said, oh, this works, and sort of one leads to another?
It was through the research. I at first came up with a, you know, master list of sort of great, iconic, famous covers. But that was, you know, 200, and it could have been longer. But so I pretty quickly decided that I wanted to, instead of including, you know, hundreds of covers and just a few sentences about each, I wanted to really tell interesting stories and sort of go in depth into the musicianship. So that led to the second criteria, which is there had to be a really good story behind it, which required research. You know, a number of cover songs, even great ones, the story is, my manager told me to cover a song, so I did, and then it was a hit. The end, which is not a wildly exciting story, even though the recording may be great. But so those, you know, were sort of cast aside pretty quickly.
You start in the book with Elvis Presley and Hound Dog, which seems like an appropriate place to start.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, girl. You're crying all the time. You ain't nothing but a hound.
Yeah, that's why I started there. My argument throughout the book and in the introduction is that the cover song really came into its own with the dawn of rock and roll. And what I mean by that is before, you know, Elvis and the 50s and 60s, everything or almost everything was a cover. You know, Frank Sinatra wasn't sitting around writing his own songs. He was just singing other people's songs and making them his own. But, you know, Elvis is sort of the transition point, because then when you get to the Beatles and Bob Dylan, who are now writing their own hits, all of a sudden when they or when anyone else sings a cover, it becomes sort of a special thing, a different thing than the standard of a rock musician writing their own song.
Originally recorded by Big Mama Thornton.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
How did Elvis come to Hound Dog?
He came to it kind of in a roundabout way. So Big Mama Thornton had recorded it and released it and had a reasonably decent-sized hit on in the African-American charts. But Elvis didn't cover it from her version. He was doing a show in Vegas, and he went to see another concert by this Vegas lounge act that's mostly forgotten now called Freddie Bell and the Bellboys.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, a hound dog, crying all the time. You ain't nothing but a hound dog, a hound dog, crying all the time. Well, now you never caught a rabbit. You ain't no friend of mine.
They did a version of Hound Dog in their show, sort of a novelty number where they were dressed up like a dog and bark and, you know, really ham it up. And he saw that and he said, this is great. And he basically covered the Freddie Bell cover of Big Mama Thornton.
Well, you ain't never caught a rabbit. You ain't no friend of mine.
Also, the one of the things that surprised me in the book, and this happens a couple of times, but there really isn't a long period of time. Sometimes you think of covers of coming after a generation or two or three. In this case, it was just a matter of, 4 years?
Yeah, it was a very, very quick turnaround. And yeah, it can go both ways. Like the second chapter is The Beatles' Twist and Shout. And there, too, it was under a decade. But some others, you know, it'll take 30 years before someone digs up an old record and makes it hit. It can totally vary.
When you listen to going to Hound Dog for a second, when you listen to Big Mama Thornton's version, can you listen to it the same way again? Because we all know the Elvis version so well.
I love the Big Mama Thornton version, and that's an interesting question. I think that you, if anything, it brings more to the Big Mama Thornton knowing the version of that Elvis did. Because if anyone hasn't listened to it, they should. It sounds totally different. Elvis added lyrics, and, you know, he makes it about an actual dog, whereas Big Mama Thornton's is more of sort of this low, guttural blues number about a cheating man. And it's really powerful, and the comparison with Elvis's, you know, sort of hammy, up-tempo novelty number, I think is a really interesting one, and it makes both of them better.
And bow wow to all of you!
When you look at the dawn of rock and roll, of course, so then it makes sense that as rock and roll goes on, that in the 80s, late 70s, 80s, 90s, that people would go back to songs from the earliest periods of rock and roll to cover.
Yeah, no, for sure. Like, I spoke to Roger Daltrey about The Who's covering Summertime Blues.
Well, I'm a gonna raise a buzz, I'm a gonna raise a holler. Son, you gotta work late. Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do when there ain't no cure for the summertime blues.
The Who were early-ish in rock and roll, but they weren't the first generation, so they were reaching back to Eddie Cochran.
Oh, well, my mom and papa told me, son, you gotta make some money. But if you wanna use the car to go a ride next Sunday. Cause you didn't work or live. Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime blues.
Who is, you know, one of the founding rock and rollers who they just loved, and they were honoring one of their inspirations. He talked about, you know, how much he loved that first wave of rock and roll and why they wanted to pay tribute to that.
I really enjoyed the story about Take Me to the River, an Al Green song.
Take me to the river.
Then covered by the Talking Heads. What brought them to that song?
They were big Al Green fans, which you wouldn't necessarily know listening to their music. I mean, they don't sound much like soul and certainly not much like Al Green. They're kind of, you know, art rock. But David Byrne, I interviewed him, and he's a huge Al Green fan. He used to just sit around listening to those records. and he decided to cover, take me to the river, because he was telling me, he said, you know, we've got, the Talking Heads had a sound, this was early in their career, they had a defined sound, but people weren't really getting it, they weren't finding much success beyond, like, you know, the coolest of the cool downtown New York kids. And so he said, what if we cover a song that people already know as a way to sort of bridge the gap and welcome them into our sound? And so he did. So people sort of recognized the song, but also it sounded so different that they said, what else does this band do? And then they ended up, of course, going on to have plenty of bigger hits of their own material. But this was their first hit.
You also write about the relationship that one act has to the other when they're covering their song. So you talk about Devo in the book and Satisfaction. The Rolling Stones like that.
They did like it. And in fact, that's sort of one of my favorite stories. Had to get Mick Jagger's personal permission to cover that song. And the reason was that their cover was so out there, so outlandish, that it could have been seen as a parody, which requires the artist's permission. So the label set up a meeting with the two main guys of Devo and Mick Jagger in a conference room in New York. And they don't know each other, and Mick Jagger has no idea who these two young whippersnappers are. And so it's this amazing scene where they're sitting around a conference room table with a boombox in the middle, and it's tense and it's awkward and no one's really saying anything. Devo plays their cover of Satisfaction on the boombox. I can't get no, no. And Mick Jagger just sits there staring daggers at them. Then about 30 seconds later, all of a sudden, without saying a word, he gets up and starts dancing around the room. And that's when they knew they had his permission.
One of the stories that also really struck me is about Johnny Cash and Hurt, which was a Nine Inch Nails cover, which I didn't know. And that's the reverse, isn't it, of an old classic artist taking a song from a new group and making it his own.
It absolutely is. And the funny thing about that one is that Johnny Cash actually didn't want to cover Nine Inch Nails. Rick Rubin, his producer, kept playing him that song, saying, John, you should really cover this.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real.
You know, Nine Inch Nails is an industrial rock band. Johnny Cash is listening to the song saying, this doesn't sound anything like me. How am I going to sing this song? So Rick Rubin, his, you know, genius was, he then went out and got a band to record a Johnny Cash-esque cover of it that kind of sounded like fake Johnny Cash, played it for Johnny Cash, and then Johnny Cash said, oh, now I get it. Now I hear what I could do with it. And so he covered it, and, you know, it was his last big hit of his career.
What have I become, my sweetest friend? Everyone I know goes away in the end, and you could have it all.
One the other interesting stories that you tell in the book, and it's a great example of a cover of a song having just a dual life, and that is I Will Always Love You, of course, Dolly Parton, and then, of course, Whitney Houston. Dolly Parton originally records it in 1974.
If I should stay, I would only be in your way. So I'll go, but I know I'll think of you each step of the way, and I will always love you.
Then in 1992, The Bodyguard comes out, that movie, the song goes nuts. That's a case where really the song tells the story, and you point that this, we have Kevin Costner to thank for pretty much all of this.
We sure do. So Whitney Houston for The Bodyguard was actually slated to cover a totally different song, a Motown song called What Becomes of the Brokenhearted. But about a month before she was due to record it, another singer covered that same song for a movie. And so all of a sudden her people realized, well, wait, it's going to look like Whitney Houston is ripping this other guy off if she now sings the song. So shoot, what else can we come up with last minute? And it was Kevin Costner who says, hey, there's this great Dolly Parton song Whitney Houston could cover called I Would Always Love You. No one else knew the song. They had to run out to a record store to go get it. But Kevin Costner just sort of said, no, this is really going to work. This is really going to work. And sure enough, he was right.
And there was a Linda Ronstadt version of that song too, right?
There was. That's actually the funny thing is they went out to the record store to buy Dolly Parton's version, but the record store they were trying didn't have it. All it had was the Linda Ronstadt version, and so Whitney Houston learned it from there. And at one point during the recording process, Dolly Parton, you know, heard through the grapevine that Whitney was recording this song, and she called up Whitney's producer and said, hey, I know you're learning it from the Linda Ronstadt version, but, you know, Linda Ronstadt doesn't sing all of the verses. She leaves out a verse. And he goes, oh, really? And so then Dolly Parton reads the producer the final verse over the phone, and then he runs in and teaches it to Whitney.
And you also say it was Costner's decision to have the opening in the Whitney Houston version be a cappella.
The producers were very resistant to that because they said, you know, radio was the primary driver of music in those days. So they said radio is not going to play a song that doesn't have any instruments, that doesn't have any beat for, you know, it's 45 seconds or something, which feels like an eternity. You know, we need to sort of produce it. We need to add music behind it immediately to get it on radio. And Kevin said, no, 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 just her voice is all it needs to have. And he fought and he fought and he fought. And he finally won. And, of course, it was a massive radio hit.
If I should stay, I would only be in your way, so I'll go, but I know I'll think of you every step of the way.
And the other thing, too, about this, you have a song like that with Dolly Parton. She wrote that song, so every time that is played to this day with Whitney Houston singing it, cha-ching for Dolly Parton, right?
Absolutely correct. And there's a funny sort of tangent to that, which is that Elvis Presley at one point wanted to cover the song. But he and his manager had cooked up sort of a scam where they would take half the songwriting credit. So Dolly said no, but as a result, she said, I earned enough money to buy Graceland once Whitney Houston covered it.
The name of the book is Cover Me, The Stories Behind the Greatest Cover Songs of All Time. It's a beautiful volume and is published by Sterling. Ray Padgett, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure having you on the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Cover Me, The Stories Behind the Greatest Cover Songs of All Time. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
So fine.
Come on and twist a little show.